From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
This morning, we speak first with Sabrina Schultz. She is the curator of biological anthropology at the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History and author of the new book, The Human Disease, How We Create Pandemics from Our Bodies to Our Belief. It's a fascinating discussion on how our humanness exacerbates disease.
Then we are joined by Roberto Cassati to talk about the cognitive life of maps. There is so much more to maps than just topo lines and trail markers, and how many other things around us can also be considered a map.
Stay with us. We'll be back after these words. You're listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Yes, we humans like to put the responsibility and blame of diseases and pandemics on the viruses causing the illness, or a diseased monkey that came in close contact with a human, or a civet cat being sold in a market for meat. But we don't seem to want to take any responsibility for our role in the mass outbreaks, our behaviors, beliefs, the ways we have negatively altered the natural world, to name a few. But without this acceptance of how humans impact and can even cause pandemics, we don't stand a chance at mitigating the next one. Joining us now is Sabrina Schultz. Sabrina is the curator of biological anthropology at the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History and author of the new book, The Human Disease, How We Create Pandemics from Our Bodies to Our Beliefs. Sabrina, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, let's first start talking about human perceptions of diseases. You know, you start the book off with a comparison of the 1918 flu versus the 2014 Ebola outbreak. Big differences in diseases and how we responded and how we perceived them. Tell us about that.
The perception of a disease and what may be causing it, especially if it's perceived to be unknown or new, can vary a lot, you know, from place to place, certainly, but we see patterns around the world and through history. Who tends to be blamed, the ideas that we go to, and even the ways that we choose to think about it that may fit in with pre-existing ideas that make it easier to manage the unknown and to fit in our responses to what else we have to do. And so, for example, in 1918, with the flu, I mean, we didn't know what viruses were. The technology did not exist to see them, identify them in an electron microscope, for example. And that was a global pandemic in the sense that, okay, we see the same things happening. I mean, here in the US, we call it the Spanish flu. Yeah, you know what they call it in Spain? The French flu. This is the kind of naming, blaming that you see happen with a lot of different diseases. You know, and how we responded here in the US was quite different than other parts of the world. You know, we had mask mandates in certain parts of the country and so on and so forth. Whereas with Ebola, I mean, you're talking about how the US audience responded to it, right? The US population. That was quite different in that it was not spreading here. I mean, this was just new to a lot of people in the US, but you know, when Ebola was spreading in West Africa in 2014, it had been known to science, you know, and a lot of people in Africa, certainly, for a decade. And so I think that with the two of them, there are so many ways to look at the differences in sort of where we were with the science and the understanding at that time, but also kind of how people fit this into what was known about how pathogens emerge and spread. I mean, the reason why I wrote this book, how I got into the business of talking about pandemics, you know, at my museum is because in the US, there's just so little knowledge about Ebola and influenza is going on to viruses that originate in animals.
Back in 2014, I worked in public health and had been studying the 1918 flu pandemic. And so much of the cause of the massive spread was because people weren't allowed to talk about how bad the flu was. It was going to disrupt the well-being and the overall community mental health, if you will, during the war. So they didn't talk about it. But then Ebola hit and we were getting calls at the health department about, well, do you have an Ebola plan? And I'm thinking to myself, actually, I'm more worried about the volcano in Yellowstone than I am about Ebola. So it was such an interesting contrast. So much of what's happened, especially with COVID, How does human perception really truly set the foundation for any response going forward to a disease or a pandemic?
Yeah, there are a number of different layers to it. I mean, so in the book, I am looking at, you know, specific, unique human features that help us spread disease. You know, it really answering the question, so why are people, why are human beings so good at spreading pathogens? And each chapter goes sort of feature or factor, you know, step by step. Some of them are looking at the body, right? And things that we can't really change in terms of our vocal anatomy and sort of our hand anatomy. But then we get further into the book with just ways that we do perceive and think about and maybe misperceive pathogens and diseases. And so I think, for example, so we already touched on xenophobia, blaming foreigners. That is, you know, part of a broader, very, you know, human process of othering. We are exceptionally good at seeing differences among each other, you know, and an other being just somebody who's not part of your group, whether it's defined by nationality or by religion or by status or race. Racism, I think, is another very important factor in how we, again, tend to blame others for being the source of or the problems around the spread of a disease, whether it's new or not. Because, you know, that also feeds into other ideas about how we attach stigma to diseases. You know, we kind of project these ideas, these negative beliefs about how a person might have been infected or how they came to be sick, which may prevent them from seeking treatment or, you know, getting the care they need to prevent the spread to others. I read a whole chapter about this, focusing in particular about HIV and AIDS. And with Ebola, I was just, you know, reading an article that we're 10 years out from that 2014 epidemic in West Africa. One study, they found that something like half of survivors still face stigma in their lives in terms of people being afraid of being infected by them because of how the virus can persist in the body or ideas about how it may remain a threat to people who, you know, don't want to be around them, don't want to be in relationships with them, and so on and so forth. One of the really powerful ways our perceptions, our ideas around how we think about these viruses and these diseases that can actually do us a lot of harm in either creating or facilitating a spread disease beyond what might have needed to happen.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Sabrina Schultz. She has written a new book called The Human Disease, How We Create Pandemics from Our Bodies to Our Beliefs. And she is a curator of biological anthropology at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. And Sabrina, you know, going back to the AIDS epidemic, for example, it's so interesting to look back because now we have so much knowledge about it, which we didn't have in the beginning. And, you know, this question of xenophobia and othering, and for a while, when AIDS was sort of discovered as being an epidemic, you know, it was first called gay cancer or something like that, right? And I think it's a human tendency to say, oh, that will only happen to this group of people. And this is why I should feel protected. It won't happen to me because I'm not a gay man, for example. And then you had, you know, someone like, we all remember Ryan White, you know, who contracted HIV and died as a very young boy from a blood transfusion. And just the enormity and the emotion that hit a whole nation who then discovered, oh, it's not just from this group. But had we as a species, as a, you know, as humans, not had that othering tendency to say, like, I'm safe because I'm not X, Y, Z, how would that change, you know, human disease if we responded differently?
It's a good question. Certainly, I write in the book, we're not the only species, I guess, that might isolate individuals who are perceived as sick, right? There's one story that I included, very sad, based on an account written by Jane Goodall among chimpanzees that she was watching in the 1960s, where one of them contracted a disease that caused lower limb paralysis, possibly polio, possibly from a human outbreak, actually, because we share a lot of diseases with other non-human primates. But nonetheless, she had the very sad experience of watching how this individual, Mr. McGregor, was shunned, cast out, and just died in loneliness, despite all attempts to remain connected to his group, as he'd done throughout his life until he became sick. As I point out in the book, this doesn't mean that those chimpanzees blamed Mr. McGregor for his illness or had that kind of deep thought about, you know, sort of what it meant, sort of made this meaning around that disease. That's what I think is really what we can identify as specifically human, that we do make it so meaningful. We make it something that says more about that individual than just that they're sick, you know, and again, that maybe it's just, you know, a species acting in protection of the group, again, is as many as we see across taxa, across a lot of different kinds of animal. And so what would it look like differently if we didn't other to this extent in the way that it intersects with disease? I mean, I would hope that it would make the experience of a disease a lot less painful for people, and probably it would reduce the prevalence of a lot of diseases, and it would facilitate our ways of using and developing tools to combat those diseases. You know, you mentioned HIV in the 1980s, the early 1980s. Because the earliest cases were happening in this country, identified among gay men. You're absolutely right. It was seen as a gay disease. Gay people were already stigmatized and cast out long before that. The chapter is called Disease the Deviance. You know, it's sort of like looking at how, you know, it's really easy to point a finger at or to target somebody who's already been pushed out or pushed down to the margins of society. So it's very, very easy to blame those people. And so that was what happened, essentially. And then when you see it spread and happen with other people, including children, that should change the narrative. And Ryan White certainly did change the face of AIDS for a lot of people, you could say, in this country, certainly. But we still have 40 million people around the world living with HIV. And that's as many people who have died from HIV infections for as long as we've known about the virus. It's heartbreaking because we have the tools to end this pandemic. We actually do. You know, if people get tested and they get treated and they remain on that treatment to the extent that they are virally suppressed, we know that they cannot transmit the disease sexually. Undetectable equals untransmissible. But a lot of people don't know about that. And so they are too afraid to even get tested because they still think, one, that it's a death sentence, as it almost certainly was back in the early days when we had no treatments, but also fears around people's ideas of how they might have contracted it, because it is associated so strongly with stigmatized behaviors like sexual activities, drug use, because it's a blood-borne virus. And so that is, unfortunately, I think one of the major factors in why we haven't ended that pandemic. And it's been one that's been highlighted by UNAIDS and a lot of global and national organizations for a long time, that we have to end stigma in order to end the HIV pandemic. And I think that we could say the same for a lot of other diseases.
Well, so much of this book really talks about, the whole book really talks about how we affect diseases and how we, our built environments, our behaviors, our evolution. And I was really fascinated to read about how humans, how the ways we've altered the natural world have now impacted diseases and our susceptibility to them and pandemics. So talk to us more about that, because I think we just go along and build more roads and destroy mm-hmm. more ecosystems without thinking about the health implications for ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, we've already talked about Ebola, for example, in 2014. That was the first instance of Ebola reaching major cities. That was the first time that we saw what you could call urban Ebola can look like, because prior to that outbreak, which had never happened to our knowledge in West Africa and that part of the continent before, you had far more spread out, less connected communities. But also, it's still unclear exactly how that particular outbreak, what the emergence, you know, from an animal might have looked like. But some studies have suggested that the likely, we think, bats that may have been implicated in a spillover to humans around that outbreak may have been displaced or may have in some way been impacted by human activities like deforestation, like extraction, that have also been happening in that part of country and elsewhere for decades. This idea of, well, let's talk about maybe H5N1, right, which is in the news right now. And that is a real concern and another great example of how we're seeing diseases, viruses with pandemic potential emerging from these kinds of conditions that are created by industrialized food production and other ways that humans are changing and have been changing the environment in very intensive ways for the past century. Think about our poultry populations around the world. I write about, you know, this idea of the Anthropocene, where humans have replaced nature as a force of global environmental change. I write this whole section about chickens. I'm fascinated by the boiler chicken. I mean, there are far more of them than us on this planet. Here we're talking about just chickens that we have created as humans that are now part of these huge populations that exist everywhere. That's not natural to have so many of a species suddenly pop up and be absolutely everywhere that people are in such large quantities. And because avian influenzas, they originate in wild birds, but once they infect these massive poultry populations, not only can people become infected, and with H5N1, almost 1,000 have been through birds since, you know, the late 90s. But also they can infect other mammals, which we're seeing now. And the more transmission you have among and between species, the more likely you're going to get mutations that will make a virus very good at infecting and spreading among people.
Let's go into the bird flu, H5N1, a little bit. And you just mentioned that you think a lot of people don't know about it. And when we don't know about it, I think it is the human nature to say, it's not affecting me, so I don't need to know about it. You know, bird flu is affecting birds, right? And so where is that tipping point for humans where we say, oh, wait a minute, this is a bigger thing or has the potential to be a bigger thing, an epidemic, a pandemic? And why do we, when and how do we tune in? And you know, like with bird flu, why should we be tuning in now?
Well, one, if you're concerned about human health exclusively, absolutely, we need to be concerned about any virus that can infect us, can make us sick, because what we've seen from these highly pathogenic avian influenzas is that when they do infect people, they're highly lethal, something like 50% fatality rate or something like that. With the current H5N1 strains that we're seeing, the different forms of this virus that, you know, are being tracked right now, generally people are not seeing signs of concern or need for a panic, I guess you could say, in that there's only been one case, it seems, of infection of a human from a mammal that's known. You know, we're just going by what's been tested and the extent to which we have eyes on this. And so it's unclear how much it would spread between people. But I write in the book about a conversation I was having with my colleague, Dennis Carroll, who was a director at USAID for a long time during the Ebola epidemic in 2014, during H1N1 in 2009, and so on. He was likening this game that we're playing with evolution and the natural world to a slot machine in a casino, like feeding quarters, just pulling the lever again and again and again. And if it's just a handful of mutations that you need to get a virus that can cause real problems for people, that's like just hitting three cherries, a really unfortunate jackpot. But it's a game of chance. But the more times you play, you're increasing the odds. And that is what viral replication is all about, because viruses, especially influenzas, they can mutate so fast.
Well, let's go back to what we touched on earlier, which was human evolution. And you're talking about just the fact that we have hands and fingernails and so much of our physical selves and how we've evolved affect our susceptibility to diseases. So talk to us about that, because we don't really think about my fingers as causing a pandemic.
I know. And like right now, nobody can see this, but like I'm touching my fingers to my mouth, you know, like I've got my chin in my hand as I'm listening to you, because this is what we do. We touch things, we hold things all the time, and we touch our faces and the mucous membrane that allow pathogens to enter our body literally all the time. If we talk about the hand, that is one feature that is unique to us, to humans. I mean, we're not the only primates with hands. They all have, they're not so different in the broad strokes, but there are some minor distinctions that make ours quite handy, I guess you could say, pardon the pun. For example, our thumb is significantly longer compared to the other fingers than other apes. And so that allows us to make contact between these fleshy little pads that we have at the end of our fingertips. It's like pad-to-pad contact, that's what we call it. Another term for this is precision gripping. We can do this not only precisely, but we can do this with a lot of strength. We are the only primate that can, with a certain combination and number of muscles in the forearm, that can actually allow us to grip these pieces of paper, for example, turn the pages of this book, pick up a pen, write a note, what have you. Because of that, we are able to manipulate objects. That's what allowed us to develop tools, to go on to innovate and dominate around the world. But that also means that we are constantly facilitating the spread of pathogens, because you know what you don't see when you look at your hand are billions of microbes. So most of them are harmless and some of them even help us, but there are always going to be some that can potentially cause disease. All of those touches can spread them. You know, I give the example of typhoid with Typhoid Mary, for example. I talk about an example of a norovirus. I mean, there are all kinds of ways that we can connect what we call fomite transmission, the contamination of objects and surfaces, outbreak of disease. But another feature that we have that's linked more specifically to pandemics is our speech. So our vocal anatomy, the aspects of our body that allow us to speak. I mean, speech in humans is unique as well. All animals communicate. They all have systems of communication, but none of them are as sophisticated as human speech. And it's partly because we have some features in our vocal anatomy that are a little different than other primates. We have a lower larynx, for example. The larynx is the voice box. That's where you get the vocal cords. And its placement and the configuration of the air tubes through which our air moves creates all kinds of sounds. And with a brain like ours, which is just highly sophisticated and supercharged, we can make more sounds and complexity of noises and therefore words like any other. That facilitates respiratory transmission.
Yeah,
we can physically speak all the time, and we love to do it. We love to gather. We love to eat together, socially, be human. And in that way, we have another, you know, serious disease risk that is built into our bodies, but certainly one we can control.
It's so interesting. So other than fingertips and the fact that we like to talk and open our mouth and we breathe at the same time, I mean, it is fascinating sometimes. It's happened to all of us at a party or something where you go to answer someone's question or you're taking part in a conversation and you just see this line of spray come out of your mouth and you go, ooh, you just cringe. What are the other ways that the human body is the perfect host for disease?
I focus on the ones that I think are uniquely human. So I don't really talk about sexual transmission, which is a huge one, but honestly, frankly, I can't say that it's so different, you know, among us, like those behaviors than a number of other species. I think our brain is at the heart of just about, if you will, it's at the base. It's a driver of a lot of what we do. Without a brain like ours, we couldn't move our fingers so independently and rapidly, right? Without a brain like ours, we would not be able to manipulate the vocal cords or make the sounds or really understand the symbolism of the language that we use. And without our brain, we would not perceive differences where there's no basis. We wouldn't see agency where there is none. That's something that we like to do as well. And that's why we anthropomorphize. That's why we sort of assign human characteristics to pathogens, for example. And we would not probably be so likely to miscommunicate with each other. I mean, there's a whole chapter in the book about miscommunication, which is, you know, a broad category, but includes disinformation as well as, you know, conspiracy thinking and theories. And we certainly saw this phenomenon of an infodemic during COVID that made it so much harder to know what was true and to be able to take the right steps, protect ourselves and each other. And I think that that is a phenomenon that with our brain, despite its many, many advantages, extraordinary abilities, and our brain, frankly, is going to be the way that we can best respond to these threats in the future. It also happens to house so many of the problems that we have to confront.
Well, I know that at the end of the book, you talk about some actions people can take to help prevent or mitigate the next massive pandemic. And one of them is no one is an island. And short of Mr. McGregor, the chimpanzee who was ostracized, which really was a sad story. Oh my God. Yeah. Are humans the only creatures, especially in modern day, that are unwilling to sacrifice any of their rights or freedoms for the common good? Because we really saw this during the COVID-19 pandemic. Is this another unique trait to humankind where it's just all about us individually and forget the commonality, the common good?
No, certainly not. There are species that are quite solitary. Selfishness is not, you know, exclusively a human trait. And there are varying degrees of sociality across the tree of life. So we are a highly social species, but we are not the only one that can also be quite individualistic. And there are those among us who certainly do not see themselves or care to see themselves as part of a collective or as interconnected to others. I explain those more cultural differences among us, cultural and social differences among the vast expanse of humanity. But the idea that we are all connected, that's really Well, I mean, the takeaways are what? That we helped create pandemics, right? Through these unique human features. But also, I hope that people understand that another thing that we can be assured of is that we have some human advantages that can help us to respond and potentially prevent some of these problems. And our ability to understand our place within nature and to see ourselves actually as part of nature, I think is a big part of it. There's the saying that in nature, nothing exists alone, right? I mean, that's ecology. And we are absolutely, we share environments, we share habitats, we share vulnerabilities with other species on this planet. And this idea that we are all connected in health, the idea of one health, certainly guides and sort of underpins a lot of the work that I do. I focus on the unique things about humans in this book, but let's not overlook all the things that we share with other species. And I think that by seeing ourselves as intertwined with the rest of the natural world, I mean, that is an important framework mm-hmm. and perception that I think is going to help us to innovate and focus on ecological solutions to problems that are going to be critical for preventing the emergence of another pandemic pathogen.
Well, our guest today has been Sabrina Schultz. She is the author of the book, The Human Disease, How We Create Pandemics from Our Bodies to Our Beliefs. Sabrina, it really shows that, yes, we are responsible and vulnerable, but also able to affect pandemics. And we have a responsibility, I think, to really do what we can to ensure that they don't happen again, even though they will. Well, Sabrina, thank you so much for joining us on this important conversation. We really enjoyed having you on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.
And that was Sabrina Schultz. If you want to look her up, it's Schultz. And as always, we will have our archived interview at kpcw.org under the shows tab, Cool Science Radio, or wherever you get your podcasts, KPCW Cool Science Radio.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
To most of us, maps are simple representations of geographical information. What trail will we take today on our mountain bike ride? How steep is the hike out of the canyon? And how do we find our way through the unfamiliar city? Although, does using Google Maps in our cars count? We look at maps as basic data for navigation, but for our next guest, maps are so much more. They can be alive. They can be cognitive. Maps have power, and they can be found in a wide variety of places, not just folded up in our backpacks. Joining us to talk about maps, what they are, and how they work is Roberto Casati, director of the Jean Nicod Institute and professor at the School of Advanced Studies in the Social Sciences in Paris, and the author of the new book, The Cognitive Life of Maps. Roberto, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation. I'm very honored to be with you.
Why are we all so fascinated with maps?
Well, I know why I am fascinated with maps. As a piece of personal history, given my age, I grew up in a pre-digital era, and I, from the balcony from my house in Milan, I could see many mountains, and weekend after weekend, I went on exploring those mountains, and we had maps. Many maps were from was called the Military Geographic Institute, so they were used probably for First World War campaigns, and then they were declassified and put into the public domain or sold, and some of them were very old with some updates. Maps for me were a way to get a knowledge of a territory, and in some cases, the only way to get a knowledge about a territory. And so my book today is an attempt to understand which kind of knowledge is it that we can get from maps and why we still use them the way we use them, although we are in a totally different era, which is the GPS era. So the fascination for maps is that they tell you stories about portions of a territory that you have never seen before or that you're not seeing now. And they connect you, wherever you are, with those portions of a territory, which is very important for you if you want to plan a route or to understand where you are, basically. Because there are so many places of a territory that you're not seeing right now. And the maps reminds you that you're part of something bigger. And I think this is my fascination for a map. And then the other fascination is the type of confirmation that you have when you get there and you recognize the place where you are because you studied it on a map. And I think it's the same happens also for for many people. So it's like, there's something reassuring about a map. One thing we hate is to have a mistaken map. It's kind of an insult to our intelligence or a break of trust. And even more than a fake news or a fake picture or an artificial intelligence generated picture, I think an artificial intelligence generated map, it's insulting to us. I mean, it's something we cannot tolerate. Fascination is there because of this ability maps have to bring us in contact with territories.
I've never really thought about this until I read your book. I mean, we don't use the same processing skills as we do when we read. We don't use the same processing skills as we do when we look at just a picture. What happens in our brain? What cognitive abilities do we need to actually understand a map?
Well, what happens if, I mean, you need some basic capabilities in order to be able to read a map. And most of these, they are perceptual capabilities, because when you're reading a map the way you're reading a text in a sense, but also you have to be able to, which is most important, to connect the map to the territory. In order for you to do this, you have to have spatial capability or organizing space in your mind. And some people do think there are mental maps that we are leveraging when we are using maps or even just navigating a territory. A mental map, we don't know what it is. We know that there are things like mental maps because we know that people are able to, when they go to a new territory, to plan shortcuts or detours through places of a territory they have not explored before. So they have some idea where they are. And then, I mean, I have a door here, but I know if I cut a door through that wall in front of me, I would get into a certain piece of my neighbor. And this knowledge is a kind of a spatial knowledge, but is only codified in something which is a mental map. So we need abilities to read maps. Reading can mean many things. It could also be a raised line maps. So you touch it if you're not sighted. So this ability to get some sensory input from a piece of reality, which is a map, and interpret that as representing a territory in which you can move. And one of the ideas of the book is that this ability is really very specific to maps. You're putting together, orchestrating different our abilities, but this ability is very specific to maps. And I'm contrasting it to other types of ways you have to navigate your territory. So there is people coming to my office, for instance, they find their way out of a building without having to ask for directions, without having to read a map. So their brain is doing something, is mapping the territory for them, without them having to do anything. But if I want to go from where I am to your place in Utah, for instance, I have to make a plan. And this plan requires me to think about, it requires me to use my memory, my working memory and my attention. So if I'm trying to make this plan and you talk to me or make me perform multiplications, I will lose my way because I'm not using all the resources. And then you can also have a different type of navigation, which is GPS-based navigation or taxi driver navigation. Somebody else, the GPS or the taxi driver are doing things for you. But when you're in front of a map, you have to be able to relate yourself to the territory thanks to the map. And then there is a lot of back and forth between the territory and the map and looking at the territory, finding landmarks on the map. In the end, it's very specific. It's something that you only do with maps.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Roberto Cassati, and he is the author of a new book called The Cognitive Life of Maps. And Roberto, I have to say that, you know, for the longest time, because I've always loved maps, and I, you know, for my whole life, I've loved to go on bicycle tours, and, you know, you really rely on maps. And when the GPS came into existence, I resisted it for very long time. Or when navigation, say Google Maps, I resisted it. And yet there are very many great uses for it now, like, you know, finding out that you should go a different way because there's a traffic accident, you know, the way that you would normally go. So it's nice to know an alternative route. However, when you start Google Maps, and you start the route, it takes away your ability to see the big picture. It just tells you where you want to go until the next waypoint. And I find it very frustrating because it takes away all of the pleasure and all of your spatial awareness in the world, right? And I'm just curious if that's something that you are also sad about.
Oh, I am sad about many things right now, but this is one of the things I'm sad about, yes. I think there would be a solution for me if I had a huge GPS-based map, like 4 by 6 feet. Why not? I mean, that would be the advantages of the old type map and of the GPS-based navigation. The problem is the screen, I think. It's more the fact that you are small screens. So GPS is fantastic. I'm a map addict, but I'm not a GPS basher. I do think GPS is one of the major changes in everybody's life, for the good and for the bad, but definitely for the good. So the story about GPS is that when it was marketed and declassified and put in the common use for commercial uses, apparently the first big wave of GPS users were happy because it solved conflicts in the couple when going in a car. So there was a driver and the spouse was looking at the map and dictating directions, and there were conflicts. And this conflictuality went down because of GPS, which apparently proved to set a success. I mean, GPS is a great change in everybody's life. And the fact that I love paper maps is not to say that I am against GPS. So GPS, on the other hand, has some problems. So one very well-known problem is that the use of GPS diminishes navigation abilities. So this has been experimentally tested in many cases, and I think it's one of the concerns that we may have. So we already know that people need to work on their, we need to train their navigational abilities in order to have them. And we know this because there are very clear differences between men and women, which appear to be related to personal history. So young boys are allowed to roam more in wild environments, so they get a better understanding of environment, and young girls are more kept under control, which means they have less time and ability to explore an environment. And the orientational abilities are the same at birth, because when you have girls that can roam freely, they get orientational abilities like boys, but the personal history changes. So the GPS has another problem, I think, which is related to what I was saying before. It is a narrow representation. And so first of all, as you said, does not connect you to the larger space unless you zoom out, but this is complicated. You never get back to the to the good zooming in. But it frees you from the necessity of looking at the environment around you. Mm-hmm. You can either have a non-map GPS, which gives you information through earphones, turn right, move left, and so on and so forth. And you don't have to make any of the connection between the map and the environment that were needed when you had a map. You cannot use a paper map if you do not look at the environment and trying to find the different landmarks. And this is problematic for me because an environment you don't have to look at is an environment that you lose. I think some of our grief of our environment comes also from the fact that we are not forced to look at it because we're not using maps. The reason I think that when I was in the United States, maybe 25 years back, for first time, 30 years back, we could have AAA maps sent over by mail. So you want to tell, I want to go from Kansas City to Brooklyn, and they would send you an itinerary, which is like the list of the itinerary that you find on any like Google Maps or other. But it was a paper thing, and you got it in the mail, and you could use it for going out. But I kept some of those beautiful, beautiful things. And now, of course, it's good, as you say, that GPS find a way for you when there are traffic jams and things like that. In a city like Paris, where I live, and I'm a dedicated biker, almost violent biker, I would say, I became a Waze resistor. So we are trying to close some small streets, because Waze uses our street as a shortcut, and this is not what streets are for. So for cities is a problem. I understand people have to drive efficiently, but not, and GPS creates this type of second collateral effect damage that we try to resist.
I just want to ask you a follow-up on this orientational ability, or maybe I call it the internal compass. You went back to boys and girls having different experiences in the beginning, and that boys are allowed to roam, and so perhaps they develop a better internal compass than girls do, which is very interesting. But in terms of internal compass, is it like a muscle, that the more we use it, the more we develop it. And if we stop using it, because all we ever do is plug in our GPS on our Google Maps, then will we all be walking around lost in the world because we have destroyed our internal compass?
Oh, for sure. So there is a famous taxi driver, London taxi driver experiment in the early 2000s. And they were measuring actually physiological differences in taxi drivers in London had to learn what they call the knowledge. So the knowledge is that they tell him, okay, go to whatever place, and they have to find it and tell you how to get there and without using a map. It was a kind of a test. And they could see that the hippocampus, which codes for spatial information, was enlarged significantly. Not exactly a muscle, because this is not the type of physiology, but training makes a big physiological changes. All type of training induces physiological changes, of course, but in that particular case, it was so massive. And now there are follow-up studies showing that as they're using GPS more and more, they're losing this type of ability. So we have to know something about human orientation is very peculiar. We are visual and auditory animals, and not like pigeons. Pigeons use a magnetosome, which are sensitive to the Earth magnetic field, or mice, they go underground, so they have to count the number of turns they take. For us, orientation is related to the ability to access distant visual landmarks. If you don't have distant visual landmarks, you get disoriented. And this happens, it's very easy to predict when you get disoriented. So it would be in the fog, at night, in the woods, in cities which are complex, because you do not access those distant visual landmarks that allow you to monitor your progress in the field. And so the issue of disorientation is people get disoriented because they're not looking at those distant visual landmarks. They're looking at the screen of their GPS.
Let's talk about what makes a map a map.
Yes, okay, of course. This is what we call a metaphysical question. What makes something something? And so I have an answer in the book, and the answer starts from considering what we call in philosophy, I'm a philosopher, contrast classes. So you want to contrast maps to other types of things that somehow looks like map, somehow seem to require the same type of abilities, but they're clearly not maps. And one is, diagrams, for instance, for expressing population about a geographical territory. So you can talk about the territory by using a diagram and not a map. Or you can describe a territory. You can even describe a route in a territory, like the column in Google Maps that tells you how to do. But this is not a map. And so what is specific about maps? So the maps are items that represent space by space. They use space, the space which is the space of the sheet of paper or space of the screen, for representing space. But of course, even writing uses space to represent space, if you describe a territory or even a diagram. So maps do this in a very specific way. And in order to specify this, we use what we call constraints, which are satisfied by maps. One is methodological. So I want to simplify the discussion and they tell you, okay, if you have a map, it has to have the same dimensionality of a territory map. So you can only have two-dimensional maps of two-dimensional territories, which is the surface of the Earth, typically. There are many objections to that, but I beg the readers to stay with me on that point. But also maps are very systematic in representing a territory. So if you take a region on a map and you nest small sub-regions, the nesting has to be found in the territory in the same way. And this does not happen with diagrams or with written text. So there is this kind of specificity. And the third thing is a map is something that you have to be able to find yourself on it, which means to find the position of the map and the territory. And this does not hold for diagrams. Then there are many things which are not maps. And then the book shows that there are many things which are map-like, or which is also a way to specify what a map is, where you can find a map. And I made the case for clock faces, which are temporal maps, or of queues, lines of people, which are mapping a certain type of position, or music notation. And as it happens, I'm a modest pianist, but I spend a lot of time on stage turning pages for better pianists than me, and which is my way to enjoy a applause from the publisher and for free, or almost for free, because you have to pay a lot of attention to find your position on the map and turning the page at the right point. And so the pianist is using the music score for producing. Music is not a map for him or her, but for me, I'm following the music and I'm following my position, her position on the map, and I just make sure that I turn the page at the right time. Of course, this technology, this has been taken care of by new technologies. Pianists are using tablets and screens, and it's a pity for me. I don't go on stage anymore.
No more public applause for you. I wanted to ask you, when you talk about the different types of maps, it's really interesting to think about that. Thinking about music on a sheet is a map. And I do know people who say, no, I don't do maps. My brain doesn't work that way. And so I was trying to think as I was reading your book of maps that make sense to everyone. And one that I think is so simple, and it's the only way I can ever remember time zones, is the time zone map. And if you look at the time zones and you align, you know, you look at those longitudinal lines that a time zone follows, I feel like everyone, it sort of orients you to where things are in the world, where countries are, where people are. And it's so simple. And it's the only way I can ever remember what time zone someone is in.
Yeah, you're right. So really the fascinating maps. I should have written about that in the book because I'm interested very much in the relationship between time and space and the way we're entangled in our representations. Yeah, what you say, I think, is correct. People are not very much conversant with maps, which is independent of their ability or not to be oriented or disoriented in a territory. It's just they don't map in a sense. But I think there is a lot of individual variation for us for everything. So I do not know if it has been systematically studied, but I expect it to be a consequence of the fact that some people are better or something than other people, and it's now. And yes, maybe there is a kind of minimum common denominator for some kind of very simple map. But I think everybody seems to be able to draw a map, provided they can draw anything, of something which is in front of them. If not, they can always create a kind of a map-like model of a scene. I mean, I give them pieces of toy pieces of furniture, and I tell them, please create a representation of your room by using these pieces of furniture, and they will do it. Maybe some small mistakes here and there, but they understand what it is about, to have space for representing space. And at the same time, there is this question of some people do not recognize some maps. But even myself, I mean, I have some maps that I have a map of the Atlantic Ocean behind me. As I'm a sailor, I was where East is at the top. And so people who come to my room are very discomforted by Caribbeans are here and Europe is up there. And I wanted the map to be oriented like this because you can see some of the routes that you can trace following the trade winds that are quite straight and they go down. They just fall into the wind trap. I think everybody should get educated in drawing maps, because you can always improve, but there is some kind of basic competence, which is space competence, that it is there for almost everybody and makes everybody able to understand and use a map for navigation.
Well, Roberto, I loved it when you talked about how clock faces are maps, because during the day, I have to look at a good old-fashioned analog clock and see where those hands are to see where I am in relationship to the whole of the day. It was reassuring to understand that I'm not the only one that views a clock as a map. So one more question before we end up. I love the idea that you talk about that pictures are maps, but not of the things they depict. Tell us more about that.
Yes. So there is a clear overlap between our notion of a map or our notion of a picture. And this is clear when you look at a satellite map and you switch between satellite and map. And satellite and map and satellite map. And they are so close that they're so close to each other that we might want to claim that maps are pictures, or maybe pictures are maps. And so, and there is a long philosophical discussion about what pictures are, whether they represent what we a kind of a two-dimensional flat visual aspect of a world or the world behind that. So when you have a picture, is it just colors on a surface? or is it more you're representing the reality behind that screen? And the solution that I propose of a picture actually are maps of the visual distributions of a distribution of light, which means they are mapping that visual distribution without representing it, and they're representing the objects, like in front of me, I have a picture of you talking to me, but they're not mapping your room. So it's a bit philosophical, this, but it solves a number of problems we had in trying to define pictures. Because pictures are, my whole life has been devoted to working on what is called cognitive artifacts, including clocks, including other. And each of them has a different representational style. And some of them are hybridations of different representational styles. So the richness of our mental life and of our culture, of our being human beings, is also in our ability to play like a music director with those different representational styles. In the case of clocks that you're mentioning, is exactly that. So we do not see maps behind clocks, although there is one, and we would see them if we had a different type of clock face, one with 24 hours, like I think it's a military time in the US, instead of 12. And then we will almost see the rotation of the Earth on a clock. But the clock is a map of the globe.
Our guest today has been Roberto Casati. He is the director of the Jean Nicode Institute and professor at the School of Advanced Studies in the Social Sciences in Paris. And most importantly, he is the author of the new book, The Cognitive Life of Maps. Well, Roberto, I will never look at maps the same way, nor will I look at clocks, music, and elevator buttons the same way again. Thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. Philosophy is about this, making you change your viewpoint on things.
Yes, and indeed it does.
That's so great.